אתם עם SBS בעברית.
Natalie Sanandaji, welcome to SBS Hebrew.
Thank you for having me here.
7th of October 2023 is a day I'll never forget. I remember where I was when the news was unfolding. I remember that hollowing feeling coursing through my veins. But I was in Australia. You were in the Hornet's Nest in southern Israel at the Nova Music Festival. Can you tell me about that day?
I was in Israel. I arrived for a friend's wedding, and I ended up staying, you know, for the holidays, be with friends and family. And I found myself at the Nova Festival. I was actually asleep when the first rockets were intercepted. Something that maybe some people don't know about these types of nature festivals in Israel is that they go anywhere from 24 hours to 3 days. So usually the festival grounds have a campsite area where people bring their camping gear with them, and you set up your tents and your camping chairs with your friends, and you have kind of a place to sit and relax in between all the dancing. Me and my friends arrived at around 1 a.m. At around 3, 3:30, I arrived with three friends, and they decided that they wanted to rest and wake up for the sunrise, which is supposed to be the most exciting part of the festival. You know, you're dancing in the dark for hours, and you're kind of waiting for that beautiful sunrise. I joined them. We rested for a few hours, and instead of waking up to the sound of the sunrise music, we woke up to the sound of rockets being intercepted overhead. Something that was always very important for me to kind of relay to international audiences was the way I was woken up. One of our friends from our campsite was on the dance floor when the first rockets were intercepted, and she knew that we were sleeping, and she wanted to come and wake us up and make sure we were alert to the situation. So she comes over, and she's smiling, and she's so calm, and she kind of nudges us awake, and she's like, "Boker tov, guys, good morning." She's like, "I just wanted you to know a few rockets were intercepted overhead, but it's fine. It's normal for the area that we're in. It's also a holiday. We know that our neighbors like to disrupt our peace on the holidays. Nothing out of the ordinary. It'll probably just be a few. It'll pass, and the party will continue." I try to explain to people, you know, imagine a festival happening anywhere else in the world. And imagine festival goers dancing and then seeing rockets being intercepted right over their heads. Imagine them reacting in such a calm manner. That simply wouldn't happen. But unfortunately for Israelis, this is their reality. This is something they go through on a semi-regular basis. A lot of people ask me, you know, why didn't you start running right away? And I had to explain to people, for Israelis, if they were to stop everything that they were doing every time a few rockets were intercepted over their heads, they wouldn't get anything done. Even though I've been to Israel almost every year my entire life, I had never been to Israel at a time of war. And this was my first time experiencing rockets. But since October 7th, I've been to Israel many times, and I've experienced firsthand what it's like to have rockets become kind of a part of your routine. I remember like being at work in Israel, like at an office, working from my laptop. Sirens go off, you run into a bomb shelter, you wait 10 minutes, you leave the bomb shelter, you go back to work, you go back to your regular routine. That's why the Israelis at the festival reacted the way they did, because they truly thought it would just be a few. This is something that they were used to. Eventually, you know, I started counting the rockets. I think somewhere between 15 and 20 is when I saw, like, my Israeli friends start to get nervous. And at this point, you know, the festival security had shut off the music, and they started announcing to everyone to evacuate the premises and head to their cars.
And what about the paragliders?
It took a while to realize that there were terrorists inside of Israel. When we started evacuating to our cars, we still thought it was just rockets. We head to our car, we start driving out, and if you can imagine, there was a little over 3,000 people at this festival. Majority were leaving at the same time. Some left first, some that were more nervous. Unfortunately, a lot of those did not survive because they were the first ones to meet the terrorists face-to-face further down the road.
I would have thought it would have been the other way around.
That's what a lot of people think. A lot of people think, like, oh, like why didn't you try to leave first? And I said, well, actually, a lot of the people who tried to leave first didn't make it because they were the first ones to see the terrorists.
Right.
And they didn't have that warning that we got. A lot of the people who stayed behind also didn't make it because the terrorists eventually made it to the festival grounds and shot all of them. They didn't have anywhere to hide. And we were like in this middle group of the majority of the people who were leaving at the same time. So we start driving out. We're in bumper-to-bumper traffic. And then the festival security gets this warning that there are terrorists.
At the festival, on the grounds.
This is when we were on the dirt road. There was like this narrow two-lane dirt road. I'm sure you've seen like photos and videos of all the cars pulled over to the side of this road. So we were on this road trying to get to the main highway. So when we're there, the festival security is on either side of this dirt road trying to guide everyone in the right direction. Maybe 5 to 10 minutes into driving in bumper-to-bumper traffic, the festival security starts screaming at all of us to pull our cars over to the side of that road and to get out and start running. And at this point, we hadn't seen like the paragliders. We hadn't seen anyone on foot. We still thought it was just rockets. And we couldn't understand why they would tell us to run from rockets. It didn't make any sense.
Were you frantic at this point, or did you understand the gravity of what was actually going on?
So at this point, we figured, you know, it's weird that they would tell us to run from rockets, but we figured they must know something that we don't know. We should just listen to them. We shouldn't question them. They're just trying to do their job. So we pull our car over and we're sitting in the car. I remember me and my three friends were like kind of looking at each other confused for like a few seconds. And then that's when we hear the first gunshots. And in that moment, you understand the severity of the situation. You understand that it's not just quote unquote rockets. It's terrorists on foot nearby and they're armed. And right away, we opened our doors and we start running, and everyone's running in different directions. Nobody knows what direction is the direction of safety. Nobody knows what direction might save your life or might get you killed. It took a little bit of time to realize even that the terrorists were coming from multiple directions, because we're running. We think that we're running from them, that they're behind us. And then suddenly we see other festival goers running towards us from far away, and we see them falling. We see them getting shot at and falling.
Did you know that they were getting killed?
Right away, we realize we're not just running from the terrorists, we're actually running towards them as well. And that's when you realize they're coming from different directions. And yeah, you realize like, oh, those people are getting killed right in front of you.
What an absolute nightmare. So then what happened? Tell me how your story of your escape.
We constantly, you know, had to change different directions. Every time we realize we see people running towards us, we realize we're running in the wrong direction, that we're running towards terrorists. We're running on and off for a few hours. About, I would say, 2 hours or so into running, we passed by a group of friends, and they were hiding in a ditch. They called us over, and they said, guys, you know, come hide with us. It's safe here. We're going to hide from the terrorists. And we started crawling into this ditch. There's maybe 10 other people in this ditch at this point. One of my three friends that I came with was standing over the ditch, and he was kind of looking down at us. And I guess he thought to himself, you know, if I was a terrorist and I found these people in a ditch, what would I do? I would shoot them right on the spot. And he started screaming at us, and he was like, guys, if we stay here, we have no chance at survival. We're going to be sitting ducks. He yelled at us to get out of the ditch, and he said our only option for survival is to continue running at all times. And we told everyone else to come with us, and they said, no, we feel safer staying here. They stayed in the ditch, and unfortunately, we found out a day or two later that none of them made it out of that ditch alive. I think that's one of the only moments where I know that the other decision would have gotten me killed. Any other moment in running, whether I chose between turning left or turning right, I have no definitive way of knowing if the other choice would have ended my life. But that's one moment that I'll always remember. And from there, we continued running on and off from gunshots. Anytime we didn't hear shooting for a few minutes, you know, we would slow down to catch our breath. I would say about almost 4 hours into running, we saw like this little bush tree, and we didn't hear gunshots for a few minutes. And we figured, you know, this would be a good moment to sit under the shade of this tree, catch our breath, and try to really understand what's going on.
Did you call your parents or anything during this time?
My mom actually called me at 8 a.m. I'm an only child of a sick parent. My mom has multiple sclerosis, and this disease is very much related to stress. At the moment when she called, I was completely disassociating. A lot of people called their parents to say goodbye because they were frantic and they understood the severity of the situation. I was in such a state of disassociation that I didn't even understand that I could die and that I should say goodbye to my mother. To me, I was like, I need to protect my mom because I don't want to worry her. I don't want her to get more sick and get stressed and worry about me. So I knew when she called, it was 1 a.m. New York time, and I knew that she was calling because she saw the news. And I was like, okay, well, if I don't answer her, she's going to start freaking out. I have to answer. She called exactly at a moment where there were no gunshots and no rockets, and we were just wandering through the fields, and it was, like, eerily quiet. I'm like, okay, it's a perfect time to answer. So I answered the phone, and I lied to her. She said, you know, like, Natalie, there's a terrorist attack. Where are you? I saw that they went to a festival. Is it the festival that you were at?
That you were at the festival.
She knew I was at a festival, but I lied to her. I told her I was at a different festival. I told her that everything was okay, and I told her I was actually on my way home. I was on a highway. I didn't have good service, and I would call her when I got home.
And that's
I didn't call her. I didn't call her until like 8 hours later, until I actually got home. I didn't want to have to call her and tell her that there's still a chance that something could happen to me. I didn't want to call her until I knew that I was safe. I called her that night and I told her, like, listen, I was there. I lied to you.
How did she take it?
She was in shock when I first told her. Like, I told her, like, listen, I was there, but I'm okay. And she kind of repeated that to herself. And we didn't really talk about it for like a year. And then on the anniversary of October 7th, I had a lot of interviews lined up and I was speaking at an event in Central Park. I was getting ready to leave the house and she kind of stops me and she's like, I have something to say to you. I was like, okay, I have to go. And she said, I can't believe you lied to me. And I kind of laughed. I was like, Ima, like, mom, like, it's been a year. Like, we haven't spoken about it in a year. But anyone who has a Jewish mother knows that Jewish mother guilt lasts forever. So she'll remind me of that every year. But she understands that I did it to protect her. She understands that, like, in my mind, all I was thinking about was what's going to happen to her. Like, is she, like, am I going to put her in a state of such distress that she's going to end up in the hospital? Like, I couldn't do that to her. So I really did it to protect her.
Natalie, I understand that your trauma manifested as disassociation, as you said a couple of times. But you also said to me previous to this interview that it was a superpower of yours. Mm-hmm. So immediately after the event, you did a lot of press tours, but then you felt like the press's sympathy towards Israel and Israelis started to turn quite sharply. Can you tell me of your experience with that?
I'll go into the superpower for a second, just so listeners can understand. In the following days after the attacks, as I mentioned, like, even as I was running, I was disassociating. And in the following days, I understood, I was very aware of the fact that I was still disassociating and that I could talk about it with people without breaking down, without crying. I understood that most of the survivors were not in the same position as I was. Most of them, even until today, were too traumatized to speak about it. I felt that I owed it to all those who didn't survive. I felt that I owed it to all those who were taken hostage. I felt that I owed it to all those who were too traumatized to speak, to be their voice. Because I felt that I was given a gift, the gift of life, the gift of the ability to speak.
Are you at all religious, or do you feel like you've become religious as a result of this? Or is there anything,
do you feel like
God was puppeteering you a little bit?
I've always been very, very spiritual and a big believer in God and a believer in the fact that we can't understand why things happen. I feel that some people only believe when good things happen to them. And a lot of people ask me, you know, did you stop believing after this? And I said, no. I said, you can't pick and choose when you're going to have faith. You have to have faith no matter what. I still have faith, but it is very hard for me when people tell me, you know, you survived for a reason. You survived because you're such a good speaker and you were meant to be their voice. I know that people say that. It comes from a good place when they say that, but I hate hearing that because I'm no more special than any of the amazing souls who didn't survive. I know people say that from a good place, but it's so hard to hear that because nobody deserved to survive more than a different person. And there's so many beautiful souls that we lost on that day. I'll go into, you know, the media when the first time I really saw them turning on us. And the first time I really realized how much we have to push our own narrative, because they're starting to push a different narrative, a very one-sided narrative. I had an interview for CNN. I was speaking at an event prior to the interview. I told the event, you know, I have to leave at a certain time. I have this important interview. They're going to pick me up and take me to their studios. And I'm waiting for that text message from the studio saying that the car's outside. We're ready to take you. And suddenly I get a message. Hi, Natalie. We're so sorry. We have to cancel your interview. We have to cover something that happened in Gaza. A rocket fell in a hospital. I knew what they were going to say before they even said it. And I knew what the truth was before the truth even came out. And exactly what I thought was going to happen happened. If you look at a lot of the attacks that have happened to the Jewish people since October 7th, and you see what these attackers believed, a lot of what they believed came from those headlines. And they later amended those headlines. But how many people are really looking at an amended headline? People are looking at the first headline that comes out. And that gets ingrained in their head.
After the fact.
Yeah. It's very unfortunate, but that's the first time I really realized, you know, that the tides are turning and that they're going to start pushing a very different narrative.
I need to hear, what role do you believe that Jewish voices like yours play in combating anti-Semitism?
When it comes to my voice specifically, not just as a Nova survivor, but also as a Persian Jew, as someone whose family fled persecution from the Islamic regime when it came into power, I think the purpose of my voice is to teach people history, to show people that history is repeating itself. Because what I've realized from most of my activism is that majority of the population has not been taught history. They don't know the facts. First of all, they don't know anything about Jews in the Middle East, Middle Eastern Jews as a whole. And that's why this narrative gets pushed of, you know, Jews being white settlers.
That came in after the Holocaust.
Yeah. Because all people learn about, I say this so many times, that we need education reform, because I truly believe that most of this anti-Semitism is fueled by ignorance and lack of knowledge. I truly believe that, because majority of the time when I go out and I speak to people who are on the other side of this conflict and believe something different, majority of the time when I come to them with facts, you know, as a Middle Eastern Jew, when I try to teach them, majority of the time they tell me I don't know enough about the subject to continue this conversation further. I really think that's what my role is in all of this, is to try to teach others, anyone who's willing to hear me out. A major thing that I'm trying to teach people is about Iran and the fact that a lot of people think Iran today is what Iran always was, that it was this suppressed place. It wasn't like that. It was very Western. It was very free. If people were to understand what Iran was like before, they would understand that what happened in Iran, that this regime coming to power started with brainwashing the younger generation. That's what's happening in the United States, in Europe, here in Australia. It's brainwashing. In colleges, it's brainwashing the younger generation. And it's scary. People don't realize history is repeating itself because people don't know history. I really do think that a lot of people's anti-Semitism is like greater than their love for their own freedom. And I saw this in one student that I spoke to in New York. We had a conversation with him. I asked him if he felt October 7th was justified. He said yes for whatever reasons he had. And then he said to me, you know, I saw that Iran tried to send rockets towards Israel. It's really unfortunate that they didn't succeed. This was the first time, not during the 12-day war where they did succeed. And I looked at him and I asked him, I'm like, are you a proud American? And he said, yeah, of course I am. I said, okay, well, I'm a Persian Jew and I had family that was born in Iran post-revolution. And my cousins who were born in Iran post-revolution, before they moved to America, they were taught to chant in school every morning, death to America, death to Israel. And the emphasis was really on death to America, not even death to Israel. So I looked at him and I asked him, I'm like, how can you be supportive of a regime who wants to see the destruction of life as you know it here in America? And he looked at me baffled. He didn't know what to say. And he said to me, I don't know enough about the subject to continue this conversation further.
So it's more emotive, you're saying.
I just truly believe we need to see education reform. I think that's the only way we're going to fix this deep-rooted anti-Semitism.
Would you extend that to any other minority out there, not just Jewish people, because, you know, there are other minorities that are experiencing similar ostracization from the community as well, or they're misunderstood or they're misinterpreted or they're overlooked in some kind of way?
Definitely, 100%. I really think that we live in a day and age where people are not learning from history. They don't actually care about facts. They care about whatever information that's fed to them that feeds a narrative that they want to believe about any minority. It's unfortunate that people would rather hear lies on TikTok and then repeat those lies because these lies feed this narrative that they want to believe, rather than going and doing their own research and then suddenly realizing that this narrative that they believed this whole time is false.
Anti-Semitism's gone up in Australia over 300%. That's according to JNS.org. And attacks towards Jewish people have happened in France, have quadrupled in France since 2024. They've quadrupled in numbers, as has Germany, US, Canada, etc. It's truly a global problem. Would you say that as Jewish communities, or we need to do something more, or should we have faith in the governments to protect us?
It's very unfortunate because, of course, we've seen that a lot of governments around the world have kind of turned their backs on the Jewish communities. And I really do think that we need to be able to protect ourselves. Recently, after I think it was a couple days after I landed here in Australia, the government got rid of the Iranian ambassador. A lot of people won't realize that that was a big win for the Jewish community, because a lot of people don't realize the connection between the IRGC and Hamas and this whole war. But of course, we know that they're the leaders orchestrating all of this, that Hamas is just little puppets and that they're the puppeteers. So some more countries need to follow in Australia's footsteps and make that happen. But it is unfortunate, especially in France. I don't see that the government would protect the people the way it needs to. And they really need to fend for themselves.
Have you done much activism in France?
Not yet. I do plan to.
Okay.
Australia was a big one on my list.
Why is that?
Because of everything that I've seen online.
Are we portrayed as the really bad country? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. In regards
That's what
to-
I hear from people overseas. They're asking me how I'm surviving every day. But I mean, I personally don't sort of feel it to the same degree as other people would feel it, and as much as it's portrayed on the news as well. I mean, you know, these things that are portrayed on the news often feel really quite dangerous, but and I'm not diminishing that at all. I completely see the validity in that. But when you live in a place, you live in a place, you go home, you know where your car is, you know where your home is, you know where your cafes are. Like,
I think that's my issue, is that I feel that my safety in New York was taken away from me. A lot of people ask me, you know, like, how did you feel when you came back home? And I said that I expected to come back home after being attacked in Israel and to feel safe, but I don't. A lot of people ask me, you know, like, why don't you feel safe? You know, New York has the biggest Jewish population outside of Israel. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's what's crazy, is that I walk around, and especially when I see graffiti on the walls or inside bathrooms of cafes and restaurants and bars, every time I see things like that, I think to myself, did someone who's currently here write that? Did someone who's currently here wish that I hadn't survived the Nova Festival? You know, recently in the United States, I think we've been seeing a rise in gun violence, in people shooting people that have different ideologies than them.
Yeah, it's such a febrile environment. How do you think, I mean, how do we take down the temperature? Do we do more outreach programs? Is this a time to double down on tolerance with other communities?
I think we've seen too many people kind of idolize terrorists and idolize the idea that it's okay to kill other people if they think differently than you. Maybe some people that think it's far-fetched for me to say that it's coming from that, but I really do feel that it has a trickle-down into people's minds and into our society, and that people think it's normal to kill someone for thinking differently than you. You know, I want to be a voice for my people, and I want to be outspoken, and I try to speak out as much as possible. So it is scary to think that it's now the norm in my society in the United States for people to kill each other for thinking differently.
Natalie, I've got a two-part question about anti-Semitism. What's your response to people who criticize Israel and the Israeli government but claim to not be anti-Semitic? Do you think that's legitimate? And I've got a second part to that question, and this is a little bit more tricky. My follow-up question is, what would you say to people, and this is quite common, when they say, that's not anti-Semitic, that's weaponizing my comment with claims of anti-Semitism? Like, who's the one in the argument to claim the what is anti-Semitic and what isn't anti-Semitic, the giver or the taker of the comment?
it is not anti-Semitic to criticize the Israeli government. I think something that most of the world does not seem to understand, because maybe they don't know any Israelis living in Israel, Israelis are the biggest critics of their own government in this entire world, bigger than any of you Americans or Europeans who are criticizing the Israeli government. They are the biggest critics of the Israeli government. They're not anti-Semitic and they're not anti-Zionist. They're proud Zionists. I think it would be weird for people to not criticize any government. I think every government has the right to be criticized because I don't think any government is perfect. But it is anti-Semitic to hold the Israeli government to a double standard. People have given so many examples like this. If Mexico were to come into the United States and kill thousands of people, would the rest of the world tell the United States, don't retaliate, don't get those terrorists who came in and killed thousands of innocent people? Nobody would say that.
But when does it border into anti-Semitism? Let's just bring it back down to the street level.
It borders into anti-Semitism when it's holding Israel to a double standard that you wouldn't hold any other government or any other army to.
Do you think people take that into their moral calculus, like when they're actually criticizing, or do you think that it's like a stream of consciousness? They say they criticize the Israeli government. At what point does it start feeling a bit funny? It's like, hang on a second, you know, like where it starts converting into something a little bit more sinister. And then who's the judge of that? Like that second part to the question that I was asking you, when you get reprimanded by someone saying, don't weaponize your anti-Semitic excuses towards me, don't overuse that word.
I think it's very hard because as soon as the word Zionism was created, it gave anti-Semites a way to be anti-Semitic, but hiding it under a different mask. So a lot of them like to say, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm anti-Zionist. To believe that the Jews do not have a right to their homeland is anti-Semitic. Anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, period. No differentiation.
Okay.
And anyone who says otherwise, that is anti-Semitism.
One more political question before we wrap up. Benjamin Netanyahu has called Donald Trump, and he said, and I quote, you are the greatest friend Israel has ever had in the White House. Do you believe that to be true?
Yes, I believe that if anyone else was voted as president, I don't think that they would have protected Israel the way that Donald Trump has. Do I think Donald Trump is perfect? No. Do I think any president has ever been perfect? No. Do I think Netanyahu is perfect? Definitely not. I don't think any politician has ever been perfect. Golda Meir, who was one of the greatest things that happened to Israel, still was not perfect. I do think that if Donald Trump was not in office, Israel would have been in more grave danger in regards to how the rest of the world saw Israel, in regards to Israel being protected in that way. So yeah, at this given moment, I do agree with that.
So the Jewish people have suffered anti-Semitism throughout the eras. We've seen it happen in Egypt and Babylon in the 5th and 6th century. We've seen it in the Hellenic and Roman empires. We've seen it in the Crusades. We've seen it in the blood libels. We've seen it in the Holocaust. Now we're seeing it in present day with what's going on. And it's almost a two-year anniversary for October 7 coming up. I know this is a very hard question to answer, but do you see any seedlings of hope for the Palestinians and for the Israelis?
I always say that also for the Iranians, things have to get worse before they get better. You know, I think after the Holocaust, we got rid of the concentration camps, but we didn't get rid of anti-Semitism. We didn't get rid of the root of the problem.
So do you believe it's possible to get rid of an ideology?
I think it takes years to unteach hate, but here's a good example. I saw a video recently of a teacher in a school in Gaza who teaches kids, I think, between the ages of 5 and 8, somewhere around there. And she said that she's writing a new curriculum and she teaches her students and she asks them basic questions that in other countries students wouldn't have to be taught or asked. But she asks them, is it okay to hate someone or hurt someone because they come from a different religion than you or they're a different color than you? And she'll teach the kids to say no. This is unteaching hate. I think in order for the Palestinians in Gaza to have a better life, I know that in order for the Iranians in Iran to have a better life, these terrorist organizations need to go. They need to have a chance at a real future, at real happiness, but they also need to unteach this hate. I think that's what people don't realize is that it's possible, but yes, it's going to take a long time. It's not going to take a year or two. Because it's very hard to unteach that kind of hate that's been taught for generations. But I do have hope because, listen, at the end of the day, we're all there in the Middle East. Neither of us are going anywhere. There's no other solution other than to live side by side, to live together.
With acceptance.
And the rest of the world has to accept that. A lot of the time, I notice that it's the rest of the world that has these extremist ideas about what should happen in the Middle East. And it's people who have never been there. It's people that don't have family there.
But that's symptomatic of the question that I asked you earlier about who has the right to give and take anti-Semitic comments and to claim what is and isn't anti-Semitic if you're not yourself Jewish. So this whole sort of arm's length criticism can be quite inflammatory. I just want to bring it back to Israel as well one more time. Do you plan on going back to Israel? I know you're American, but where do you feel more safe and where do you feel more of a sense of belonging, America or Israel?
I've been back about 5 times since the war has started. I feel much more safe in Israel than I do anywhere else in the world. And a lot of people ask me, but how can you feel safer there? You know, like, you almost died there. I survived the 12-day war there. There's constant things happening there.
The 12-day war with Iran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel safer there because I know that when I'm walking down the street, I'm surrounded by people who are not out to get me, who think the same as me. I feel comfortable there. I feel safe in that sense there that I don't have to look left and right before I speak Hebrew out in public. Mm-hmm. I can't stand this idea of feeling uncomfortable in my own home, of not feeling like I can openly be myself in public. And that's how I feel currently in the United States, in most parts of the world. And I know that most Jews and most Israelis would agree with me. And I feel the most safe and comfortable back in Israel.
Natalie Senandaji, thank you so much for joining us on SBS Hebrew.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להאזין לפודקאסטים.